She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. This show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in sustainability, and we thank them for their ongoing support and for everything they do for this community and for the planet. So I invite everybody listening to sit back and get ready to listen, because we have another exciting, never had this topic on a show guest today. The name of our show is Learning to Love Weeds, and our guest is Jerome Fregenet, and that is my English pronunciation of his name, and I want you to say it in French. I even practiced it online.
Well, thank you.
I did, because you cannot speak like a Frenchman. It's very tough, very tough.
It's maybe a formation of the jaw. Or
and the tongue, and I was practicing it. I was glad nobody was watching, because they would have thought I was crazy. But anyway, he is an executive chef and author of a book called Cuisine Everlasting, and someone who has hope and creative ideas about our food supply, which might even include eating edible weeds. Welcome, Jerome.
Well, thank you for having me, Gina.
It's great to have you. And before we get started, I have a quick announcement that I'm really proud to announce. We have launched the 5th annual Arizona's Greenest Workplace Challenge. Great for people in Arizona. It's going on right now. And it's our way of showcasing businesses in our state that are committed to sustainable practices and are proud of their efforts to preserve this great planet of ours. We love this challenge. If you're an Arizona listener and are the owner of a company, or if you're listening in New York City and you have a cousin in Arizona and they're doing something green, call them, let them know this contest is going on. This challenge is on our website, mrsgreensworld.com. You can nominate them. We'll be accepting applications through October 17th, and then let the voting begin. People can vote from all over the country. And it's great to see the website so that you can really get a feel for how many companies are committed and proud to announce what they're doing for a healthier planet. And people, I'll be expecting you to vote from all over the country, because we'll be doing our best to spread the good green word. So let's get started, Jerome. And I think it's always good. I don't ever want to start with that song, Let's Start, in the very beginning, even though I probably would like it. Talk about your background. What in your life took you in the direction of becoming an executive chef? Tell us about where you've traveled on this journey.
Well, into the childhood, of course, being riveted around food, having the family's businesses and conversation around the table, all around the central aspect of the goods that we put into our mouths, but also our environment and the athleticism of a child, of course, is pushed. So I was into the tennis national program, and I was very much into service, of course, and making sure I was successful at it by going with one serve. And when I had an accident, a little motorcycle accident, that it turned my ambitions upside down and went into the service industry.
And that took care of your career.
That took care of my career.
That direction, but you were supposed to be doing something else, clearly.
Right, of a different service, of a different aspect. An angle that was definitely riveted on pleasing and teaching what was being taught to me.
Now, in your family, like, was it your mom and dad who cooked, or your mom, or did you grow up in a family where it was just healthy eating was part of your everyday life, or was there a real active interest in food professionally?
a huge interest professionally, but also into having a connection to our soil and our gardens, our farmers, not ours, but the neighboring was, of course, not just a choice, but a necessity to be using the seasons and using what was local. My grandpa was a master chef, my mom a pastry chef, a couple generations before me also. And it, from the wine in Cognac to the Bordeaux region, Saintes, where I grew up, that has so much also seacoast that offers really a multitude of cultures that have moved. If you could compare it to California, that part of France, the southwest, was inhabited by England for 500 years, but also all this migration from the south and the east to create some amazing dishes. Not only the prunes, but the melting of the chocolate and the coffee early in 1500 started to be part of the terroir. And the meats, the fish are very well represented into all of the traditions of Europe. Coming in this country at the age of 17 and going into 5 years of FASES and learning in big hotels with international, already well-proven seasoned chefs, I, of course, saw an adaptation that was taking place that was not already it couldn't be referred to the same culture as a French sauce. It was at the time in Arizona, in Scottsdale, at the Guinea Ranch. It was an Arizona Scottsdale hotel that was making sauces and with ingredients that were coming from the region. Without knowing, we were already talking about a specific sauce. So, without losing everybody, I just want to show that there is a vegetable trace mineral, an element that is also reflected where the vegetable grows.
And so let's fill in a little bit of the gap. So you were in France, and what just blew me away when I was doing the research on the show is why you ever left in the first place, because you were in some very, very, and I'm like, okay. Then you went to ASU, and then, you're living in San Francisco. No complaints about that. That's right. One of the most beautiful places on earth to live. But in terms of a couple of steps along the journey, you traveled, you came to the United States. I have to tell you this. I just watched a special, probably in preparation for your show, an hour special with Anthony Bourdain, who I think is totally crazy, and like him a lot. But he went to do a complete tour of French food.
Okay,
and
good.
Really went in depth about it's really not a lot of what we do in America. There is such... such ceremony, it's ingrained in the culture. It's getting the, I'm trying to think of the word for the mushrooms. I mean, the executive chefs there, it's, and maybe it is in the United States, but there's so much history and things passed down from generation to generation. I mean, here kids can, in sixth grade, decide they're going to go to chef school. Not a lot like that in France. There's a lot more of the history. Is that safe to say? That's a pretty long question, but I was looking at the cultural richness of someone that decides to be a chef in France.
You're correct. I would say still in this country, without generalizing too much, a huge tradition that has taken place over the last 200 years within the farming communities, it's been eroding itself, even in Europe, of course, and with the pace of education, but also the urbanization of our time in the garden, or understanding having extra time to go gathering, it's a minority in Europe that is being able to continue this. And it's a certain commitment that the parents and the children, that the neighbors are living within. But you're right, it's ingrained.
It's ingrained. It's in your blood, and I'm sure it is being compromised. The fast food and they should call it the fast non-food, because it really isn't food. That's what I'm going to start doing. Hashtag non-food. It's like it's not really food that we have in our fast food restaurants and in a lot of restaurants. So let's go ahead. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. I just want to point out the nuances, but also the similitude between Europe and even the First Nations, the tribes, and the ancestry behind not an ingredient only, the plant, and this connection with the environment, and to trace a climate, a region, is the reflection of the sun, the humidity, a moisture level that is acclimated, of course, to where we are, and to respect now the transportation and to start to talk locally, we have to also include the plants, their escapes, and the plants of the Sierras and the Mesas in Arizona, but also the coastal and the hills of Sonoma or Big Sur, that are already the life support, but a genome that is meant for the people that live in the area.
Because I so get it. So you're saying that they're the plants. I'm going to translate the science, because this is a very scientific concept that you're talking about. I mean, it is, but it's what I'm supposed to do. And Jim Beiser says hello, by the way. Our friend Jim Beiser was glad I was having you on the show. So is that food in the areas in which it is grown is actually connected to supply the nutrients for the people in the area in which they live, so that if we get a tomato that's from that's gone 3,000 food miles, that's been probably processed. I don't even like to say grown; they just processed tomatoes. They don't really grow them. I mean, I'm kind of jaded on this subject.
I'm glad that we can move on toward the
yeah, that's right. So it's like that's a food mile I've had Gary Nabhan, who is certainly a food expert, and that's what he's talking about. And it's a win-win-win, because if you're living in the Southwest, for example, you want to eat more drought-resistant crops, get the nutrients from those things that are growing here, and it helps with the whole circle of life. So let's just skip a little bit, not very much. You had success as a chef, and you were in America. And then this was one of the most fun research things I ever did, because I would like to meet scientist Jeffrey, I don't even know how to say his name.
Klopatek.
Yeah. Because you two hooked up, and it was probably skyrockets in flight at Arizona State University, and you wanted to teach students about biodiversity and sustainable foods at the restaurant called Ingrain at the ASU's Tempe campus. Now, can I just do a quote from you that I read about, which I think is a great segue for you to talk about what your vision was?
Please.
My goal has been to provide high quality but simple food for students, staff, and faculty built on a foundation of sustainability. And Jerome, I just did an interview with a guy named James Costa, who produced the movie Lunch Hour, which is what we're feeding our kids in the school for lunch. This concept, sadly, is noticeably absent from what we're feeding our children, correct?
Unfortunately, correct. Yes. And
so what was your vision for this wonderful place that kids could go to eat called Ingrained?
Well, it was very much a platform that had a mission of having a small radius, 50 miles, 100 miles, to be able to start tracking it also, and to to define what was going to be local and seasonal was truly the interest of many chefs and students and teachers that were coming to the restaurant. So to not go into something too eclectic and to represent our environment, to have an ecology with also an economy, that starts to prove a certain price per plate and a food cost that works, add its certain challenges, truly. Yet
that's so honest. I mean, because it does. It's really, making it work financially has to happen too.
This time there was a good twist because of the power and the magnitude of 80,000 students,
right.
campuses
right.
everywhere.
That helps. You've got volume built
right.
in.
But there was no convincing to be done with Ken Sings Farm. Sings Farm in Tempe, Scottsdale, and amazing. And well, it was about 7 miles away, 12 minutes from the restaurant itself, an ecosystem second to none.
Really. And what was the name of the farm?
Sing. S-I-N-G-H.
Wow.
Sing
okay.
Farm.
Good to know. It's a
little oasis with trees that I couldn't wrap my arms around that had grown in 5 years,
wow.
creating this amazing compost of life where just right under the surface, the white bacterial life, the nematodes, the worms that were right there in the middle of the summer on the reservation, the Pima side of the, I believe, the loop that goes south-north on the east of Scottsdale, to not even hear the cars that are less than a mile away. There's something very special.
I am so going to go visit that when I'm up in that area. I mean, I never heard of it until you mentioned it, and I'm Mrs. Green. Like, what?
He's not only, and Gary knows very well about him. He has received so many accolades. He's not only a state treasure, but a national treasure into what he's able to do with the organic clippings of the botanical garden, all the gardens of ASU, to turn them into this soil that is so enriched and that has such a life force, where this was a main source of produce, and Ken started to offer some amazing stuff beside the tepary beans, beside the mesquite,
right.
also beans,
right.
and some heirloom passed on tribal plants that were starting to come in from some amazing corn that was really from the mesa, showing the variance of grain. You know, it looks almost like a grain of rice when it's grown in certain altitude and dryness. And it is good, of course, to be thinking in the same terms as the peppery bean or the mesquite that has such a low glycemic count that it will last for 8 to 12 hours, depending on the amount used into a meal. It's
and not genetically modified. I mean, thank everyone for the seed savers. I mean, we just the thought of eating a piece of food, like we had corn the other night, and we were honest. I mean, we wanted corn, and we just went and got it and said, well, you know, we'll get non-GMO corn at the farmer's market this weekend, but we knew what we were eating. It's kind of scary. And, you know, I know that you are not going to believe this, but we are going to have to take a short break. It's going fast, and I love what you're having to say. And I hear the airplanes in the background. Is that what's going behind? It's okay. I mean, this is a real show, and you said there might be some background noise, so it's really okay. When we come back, I really do want to go into some of the terms that you wrote to me about and explained some of the science. Ecologenomy. I want to talk about that. Let's talk about beyond food security within the ecobioflora.
Right.
And the I think there's a lot of interest in vertical rural urbanization. I mean, that's got to happen. And you talk about social plant welfare. So we've got lots to talk about. I mean, we really do. So I'm ready. And everybody, please stay here with me. This isn't just to me. You've got me sucked in. We're talking with Jerome Frejenet. He is an executive chef and author of a book called Cuisine Everlasting, and someone who has hope and creative ideas about our food supply that might even include adding edible weeds. Please stay here with me. We've got lots more interesting and fun stuff to share. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
For almost 40 years, Bookman's Entertainment Exchange has been the place for used books, music, movies, and video games in Arizona. From the latest bestsellers to out-of-print classics, we have you covered with 3 Tucson locations. And now you can buy, sell, and trade musical instruments. Our newly expanded sections are chock-full of top-notch instruments. From beginners to seasoned musicians, we've got something for you. Open 7 days a week, shop, hang out, and enjoy our free Wi-Fi. Bookman's, good for your pocket, good for the planet.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today is all about learning to love weeds, and we are going to get to that. And I have to admit that our guest today, Jerome, see, I said Jerome. Jerome Frejenet is really putting our brains to work, and that's what Mrs. Green's World is all about. He is an executive chef. He's an author of a book called Cuisine Everlasting, and he's someone who has hope, true, has creative ideas about our food supply, but someone who is truly connected to the concept from farm to table in local regions and why that matters very much for our own food security, for our own health. And I am learning so much, Jerome. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Gina, again.
I know, it's complex.
It's going quick.
Subjects. It is going quick. So beyond food security within the eco-bioflora, what do you mean by that?
Our food source has gone from another plane.
Yeah, but, it's okay.
Okay. It has gone from having close to 1,000 plants seasonally from summer to winter, and now we're dealing with about 12 plants that we must see throughout the year.
From 1,000 to 12?
Yes. And the amount of apples, 7,000, that we have now at the grocery store that do represent what is already out and about growing for a couple hundred years minimum to be called an antique or an heirloom.
Right.
And what is heirloom also is this whole bridging of our migration and also the seeds migration.
Right.
So what is around the farm, on the path, on the sidewalk, and into also the little forest, the little woodland that is around the fields, but also going toward the mountain and going toward the coast. Also, in between, on the wind path, is what is getting a little attention, more so than it was 5 years ago. There's quite a bit of momentum, not just of hope, but of action that are taking place.
And so is that really what you call weeds? I mean, I read a lot about it, and I talked with Jim Beiser about it. Do we call it weeds, but it's really just another form of good food that we haven't given a healthy, acceptable name to?
Exactly, because of the identity that we tend to call plants objects.
Right, right.
But yet it has a name and a gender. And it is not...
And it's alive and it's growing.
And it has an ideal of multi-generation and the change that happens past the sprout, the change that happens when it goes from a little shrub to a big bush to a tree.
And right.
It's that progression that we are not accustomed as a culture, agriculture, to let it go beyond the point of sale. Yet, the nutrition of a full-bloom pumpkin that is going to have all of the extraction of its own trace minerals in the soil,
right,
versus just the flower, we can comprehend, of course, that it's two different aspects of it. And it is this both part of the plant that have to be taken in account, and we don't need to necessarily abandon the root system and cut it off because it's dormant again. It has a chance to come back next year.
Right.
It's a lot of it has to be thought of also by what is going to come in next year. The dandelion and the nettles are the examples that I wanted to touch on.
And that's awful, and you can eat them, right?
And because it's, yes, not only we can eat them, but they have different time of the year when different values, and it's our own ecology that as a science and as an art of living, it's that bridge that we must pay attention. We work in the field, but we must pay also due respect and take a piece of the offering from the wild radishes, the mustards, the fennels, and all the little wild onions that are growing on our way to work. If we are really still tending the land, this is part of our duty to pay attention to.
And to just, I mean, it's so funny, the things that we do when we're out in the country and we'll see all these beautiful wildflowers and say, oh my gosh, they're so beautiful. But if they grow in our yards, we pull them up because they don't go with what was planted. You know, my husband says that a lot. He goes, yeah, we call them weeds if they were growing in our backyard. So that's exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Gina, please.
No, another thing, I mean, you talk about biodiversity abundance, and with all of the discussion with so many of the people I'm sure you know and stay in touch with or read about, we're in a food scarcity, food security mindset a lot. The government is getting engaged, a lot of food tank think tanks are, and what I loved about your message and your vision is that we do have biodiversity abundance if we're just going to start looking at what we have called undesirable plants. Is that right? An accurate statement?
Exactly. The undesirables are the solution. And nutrition, density represents so much potency, and they can emmagasine, they can take in so much without having to be having much water added. They
right.
are there to be tended by just the moisture in the morning. The dew is enough, and they have adapted to this for us also to be not just taking advantage one more time,
right,
but sharing the value. And that shared value is what the at this point, the economy, the number, the quantification of having an aquaponic system that grows, okay, tomato and cucumbers, Verdes, aquaponics, Watsonville. Verdes is an upcoming huge potential aquaponics that with the fish, not hydro, but aqua, with the sturgeon, local right. fish of California, enriching the water, feeding the plants, but also respecting the pourpier or the purslane, having a ice lettuce that is local of this flora. And the chefs have been looking for those. We are finally starting to understand that there are besides the banana, there are plantains and plantanos that are a small shrub that is looking like a grass. And yeah, it's...
But where would you say, I don't want to interrupt, but our chefs, you know, I go in this world sometimes that I think I live in the bubble because so many people are living consciously that are my friends and, you know, a part of creating a global community of people who care about the planet. Are lots of chefs from where you sit getting on board and really looking for biodiversity abundance for the right
oh, yes.
reasons? Okay, great.
Oh, yes, yeah. There was an explosion. Marc Vera, great master of mine.
I love that, an explosion.
There was a revival, really, that happened when Noma took off the scene as the best restaurant globally, Copenhagen, using their winter produce in the restaurant under the ice.
Oh, my gosh.
And of course, the chefs were... mature and the culture media respected it to name it the best because of this effort in not molecular only but in now in biology and in a local subculture of what is native in the here and in the now. And so in the now in the right season, the cruciferous, for example, that can withstand the cold and the ice. It's a miracle.
It's a
wonder for me.
I mean,
what it does for the body when we do eat the right time of the plant and its fruits is a fruit to be shared. And again, a native plant or an invasive plant is what we need to touch about, is this second class, third class, kind of as a immigrant or a native anomaly that we need to keep on a reserve or to keep aside or to have a huge campaign. Millions and quite a few billions are spent to eradicate noxious plant, of course, for the safety of agriculture. But there's a limit. And there is now a need to grow the amaranth. But the amaranth that grows in the middle of the soy plants are becoming a big problem, and they're called superweeds. But this is an amaranth that grows for hundreds of years already. Mm-hmm. And that's when there needs to be an adoption, like a portfolio of diversity also for the soy plantations, where it goes from plantation now to monocrop diversity, and an adaption also to what grows on its own beautifully with a little help to put it on the market without having to go and gather into areas that need to be rested.
So to
forage, if I may say, to forage is a Renaissance term to stop, to want to encourage people to go gather their own meals. Because of the social class that came about during the first birth of banking in Europe with the Medici, and think about it, Catherine de Medici and the uncles that were supporting at the time the first marketplace with the export-import of produce. That's the beginning of to call the wild forage for the animals. To forage is a term used for getting the weeds for the pigweed. And this is this makes me laugh because this is what I'm a happy pig because I'm having all those little beautiful and you see the French will call the mugwort armoise, and that's still beautiful.
Yeah, but, yeah, it is.
But there is a social disgrace because of growing into society, wanting the opulent vegetables from Italy, living in France, and starting to discriminate against what grows freely because it doesn't grow with a market system.
Right. Now, the most common example that everybody can think of that's shocking are truffles and the harvesting of truffles. It's like they're black gold. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. But let's recap what the concept, because in your notes, very good notes, you make the point, and this is to me why it's so applicable, that every multinational corporation has a common goal. They want to diversify their portfolio. They don't want to have one big thing, one big customer, one big product. And what you're saying is, so does the food industry, but the more obscure concept is the diversification of the general population portfolio. And I get that. It's like it's easy for us to ship green beans from wherever they're growing them, from all over the country, to eat green beans. And what you're saying is to look at the diversification in the areas and make the food work because it's healthier, because it's going to be more prolific. We have the whole shipping issue. Is that, am I translating it correctly?
Yes, and also by the nutritional value.
Right.
Yeah, and so there is the right bean for the right area.
Yes.
And it's going to fight against, there's going to be very little need of pesticides because of already the natural sugars that are there to fight against its enemies that, of course, want to take the sap off. And as soon as the sugars start to get high enough, most bugs, they have no liver, so it turns to alcohol at a certain dose. And they have also the right antiseptic to be able to protect them against the runoffs of its own mud or of the plants that live in the area. So it comes with already all of those values, like an oak, like the truffle,
right,
like the acorn, and like the bark, because it's that bark that is the cork. The corks of all the bottles comes from oaks, and that oak is the majesty, right, of all the forest. It's what is the perfect picture, if we may speak about it a little bit more, because it has the truffle, but it has the acorn that produces like 2,000 pounds or sometimes 2 tons per tree.
Wow.
And of course, not just the tribal Indians, but Europeans all around the Maghreb, Berber, Spaniards, Basque, Southwest, Korea, China. These are respected and used still. The
acorns?
And this is my top passion, acorns.
What do you make out of acorns?
You make what you would make out of chestnuts.
Oh.
And it has actually tenfold the value of chestnuts because of its density.
And it tastes good? Acorns taste good? Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
You're going to have to make me some acorns someday, Jerome.
With pleasure. I'm making everything with about 20 to 30% of acorn within my batter.
You are kidding.
Yes.
That is exciting to me because as a kid, I'm from New Jersey, and we used to collect them and do all. We probably threw them at each other, but we just had my brothers and sisters and I would go and collect acorns. We'd have buckets of them and not eat them. I had no idea, and that's a very happy surprise that you brought up for me. It's like you're cooking acorns.
As much as I can right now. Every weekend, I go and gather close to 100 pounds. And leach out the tannin just slowly in cold water. And that tannin, the runoff of the rain off of the acorns and the leaves of the oak in its natural environment, the tannin is, again, a solution to the problem of being able to...
Yes.
To treat its own environment.
You talk about and prolific. I mean, right. that it, is, it, yeah, there. We're going to have to take another break,
okay.
believe it or
okay.
not. I mean, it's like, I just, you know, it's like, okay, I'm getting the 2-minute warning. Now it's a 1-minute warning. Everybody, you're going to want to stay here with us. We are learning so much from Executive Chef Jerome Freshenet. Now I'm saying it. He's an author. He is an executive chef. He is a thought leader about food, and we all should be paying attention to what he says. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back for our last segment.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And we're certainly getting an opportunity to think about a lot of things, out-of-the-box thinking, healthy thinking, connecting earth to our bodies thinking. Our guest today is Jerome Freshenet. He is an executive chef and author of a book called Cuisine Everlasting, which I hope we get to talk about a little bit. He is someone who has hope and creative ideas about our food supply, which we all need to be paying attention to. And Jerome, before we go back to you, I have a quick announcement about our membership program. It's a subscription program that we ask all of our listeners to become an official supporter of Mrs. Green's World to help keep our broadcasts like this free and independent. It's so easy to become a member. You visit our website at MrsGreensWorld.com, click on the Preserve Our Planet icon, and hope you do that. Another quick reminder, you want to be able to have these shows on the go, and now we finally have a great app. It's called Igloo Radio, I-G-L-U. Again, it's on our homepage. Visit it, click on it, download it free, and you can take Mrs. Green's World podcast with you to the gym or on your walks or just sitting doing something better than watching what I call dumb TV. You'll learn from these shows, and I invite you to download our app and just listen to these extraordinary guests. So, Jerome, I have some challenges about what to cover in this next segment. So let's leave it to you, because okay. one of the things that I'd like to talk about is that shocked me is every 10 to 15 years, thousands of new species of animals to plants are being discovered or rediscovered and categorized. That shocked me. There's an estimated 10 to 15 million uncategorized species in our little planet. And what I say is That's counter to what I think we are being led to believe, and that we need GMOs to save us. If not, we're going to starve. So is that one of the topics we can cover in this last segment? Because that was a really important point for me to discover.
Yes, I would say the Genentech, Monsanto, Second Genome are some bridging company with organic agriculture, and there's a lot of study that is being made right now to be able to facilitate absorption of minerals within the soil, within the water. And there's a lot of bacterial and probiotics instead of antibiotics that are being studied as the next generation for farmers to use. So there's equally an original calling from as a nightshade example of tomato, eggplant.
Right.
There's, of course, a whole array in California, Arizona, to Canada of nightshades that do very, very well. And in most regions, they are called sunberries, and they come out about, they give out about 4 or 5 crops during the year. And those are the acai, the local wild blueberries that you would find not in the mountains, but in most of sea coast elevation. These are, of course, now being talked about again as, let's take a look at the original, the wild one, and retrace also what we can do with a tomato closest to that because of its antioxidant values. And this, all of the potential that those plants have to protect themselves are also made for us with all those other cells that we have in our lungs, but in our gut system, 80,000 different cell of bacterial living that thrive in our gut system to give us the immune system. Close to 80% is in our gut flora, and our environment therefore is truly connected to it. When we cross that borderline of its natural food versus our supplements, that's when we go into, there's a supplement crisis also, of course, because of having no more minerals left into the soil, the runoff of fertilizers. And that has a true value and an ecological consequence that needs to be respected. So that's when we start talking about our local natives, invasive edibles that need to enter the vertical aquaponic systems that are starting to blossom and to be the model for urbanization, to have a source.
And to help feed the growing population. But let me ask you this. When you say that this is, you know, being discovered or rediscovered and looked at, is there a part of you that gets, like, really worried that the big dogs, and they are dogs, like Monsanto and some of those people, are going to take it and look at it and say how can we genetically modify the heck out of this and add it to our portfolio?
And it makes me laugh. I'm sorry, Gina, but don't worry. They're coming to me already. They're asking me for project, the Second Genome or Genentech, Monsanto from Stanford. Everybody wants to be like talking to a chef or a farmer about, like, oh yeah, the weeds. And
you're not going to do it, right, Jerome?
No, because
get away.
Get away, because it can't be mastered. It can't. The seed, and I mean, we have to pay due respect to who created what, and to claim ownership of a bacterial, an enzyme in the water or the soil. There will always be nature taking over creation again. retreating to leave it taking over even concrete. And I have no fear, at least over time, that a field of soybean or corn is taking over very quickly. Of course, within a couple of years, it's destroyed by its neighboring life that is ready to take over. So
you have hope in the ultimate power of nature. So there's all these genetically modified crops, and it's a negative comparison would be we come up with all these vaccinations to fight viruses, so they just come back, they mutate, they come back stronger. And what you're saying is, I've never heard anybody say this, Jerome, and it makes me really happy, that nature will come back and be back in its own healthy form. Is that what you're saying? We can keep rooting for Mother Nature. Yes.
Yes. Oh yes, we can. We can, Mrs. Green, for sure.
Yay! And that makes me really smile, because some days it's kind of daunting.
Even in antibiotics or now probiotics, to be able to give more of an organic portfolio for Monsanto or Genentech, there are supplements for soil, organic, designed by those companies already, and they cannot also try to now claim the good of nature.
Right.
And it's defies again where this organization is going to go against. It's already such a cycle that does siphon itself out of a strange synthetic to process back into a life form. Because what is under the soil is not death, it's so much life. And the root system, the electrical power, and what I learned, of course, is that charge of electrodes that are left with all those enzymes that are digesting the soil around the roots. And this is what power also the nervous system of the plant. And this is what comes from lightning, and that gives a certain horizontal versus just going down for those horizontal split. That charge helps of low frequency, but also the high charge of the summer coming as storms every summer night. This is part of what we are now scratching, and we don't need to recreate that. We're just studying it. Observing it.
It's so clear when you're talking about it, that your passion, when you talk about the earth and the life force beneath it and the nutrition to our bodies, like really feeding our bodies what it needs. And the other thing that I want to talk about before we have about, I don't know, like 8 minutes left or less.
Okay.
What are the next step? You have a vision for a next step in your description of designated strategic areas, which I would call a replicable model, so that, you know, you could have a strategic area in, you know, Patagonia, Arizona, that didn't look anything like a strategic area in Monterey, for example. So can you talk about what your vision is for that and what it would look like?
For sure. I'm looking at the work of Dr. François Couplon.
Don't ask me to say that, Jerome.
Okay. François is a dear, dear friend, and a doctor in science, did a thesis at the National Museum of Science in Paris some 30 years ago that led Marc Vera, the three-star Michelin and 2020 Gimio that surpassed all the chefs in the early 90s, that inspired all this mountain gathering of not just spices but plants. And François is the ethnobotanist of choice for the best chefs in Europe, and Noma, René Redzepi, as well as learn everything from his expertise that has been working with a plant source that is based on history and of beyond the first 3,000 or 4,000 years as a paleo-ethno expert.
Right.
There is a direction. So he has a college, and a lot of students are coming out as disciples that are also not fighting the farms or not fighting already what the chefs are doing, but giving us a an opening to what they thought was to be destroyed is now a partnership, a marriage, an alliance.
Food. Oh my gosh, food, it's plants. So exciting.
It was in my 30 years of cooking. In the last 3-4 years, I see it in the media like no other. It started about since 2003, 2008, it was apparent, and 2012, now it's really entering the vocabulary of the permaculture, and it is totally acceptable, even in California, to be tasting all of the wild sage or all of the, at least what chefs are portraying is what we've been talking about with François and I for a while. So there's a good amount of progress, and the modern farms, aquaponics, that are using, saving 96% of the water, that are starting to want to grow those produce beside the tomatoes and their cucumbers to give a 10, 15, 20% of the produce to the restaurants that are examples, and the it's a discovery. It needs to be taught. It needs to be tasted. The mouth wants to put it into the test of, do I like it or not? And it's like tasting a soup of lobster for the first time, you know?
Yes, and you're saying, what excites me about what you're saying is that you're talking about a system that addresses what I think are so many of the major challenges: our compromised food supply because of most of GMOs, our water scarcity issues that are going to be more and more devastating every day. We're seeing them. Gary Nabhan, when he was on my show, said 23 counties in the United States in 2013 suffered from severe drought. So I think the introduction from your perspective about aquaponics is really important. And in the time that we have left, just paint me a little picture of what will the future food market look like when we go to our farmers market. What will we be finding? Will we be finding strange things like we're not quite sure? Will we be buying acorns? When you say that, not just our food, our local, farmers markets, but our supermarkets as they go to reduce their food miles, what does Jerome say we'll be shopping for?
I take a look at France, Germany, a few markets like that are a few years ahead of what America is doing. And yeah, it's of course a stranger look in the apple. It's going back toward the species and the families related to the apple that is now having a name. And we're going back toward what nothing is new under the sun, and it's just to realign a culture to identify those produce that are native or that are doing very well now for the last 500 years.
Right.
We don't need to go back to what was 10,000, but just what is now. What is now is what the farmers are being taught that is under their walking over is eatable, and chefs are learning this with the higher education, but also with the public in large, with this power brain that we have in our hands that is connected, and we are having, therefore, the honeysuckles having a chance to, or the cactus, or all of the things that we thought that was just dangerous have a now room aloe, agave, not just syrup, but fresh agave heart. That is what we're going to see.
Oh my gosh! So it gives it's not all gloom and doom. It's hope.
No. There's more variety in New York. There's more variety in San Francisco than there was 3 years ago, and at the market you'll see all of those things that were processed now that are in a natural environment.
Well, when I come to visit you, I'm having something that you made that has acorns. I can tell you that because I want it. That excited me a lot. So we have 1 minute left. I have to say thank you. I have to just do two quick announcements about what we have coming up. This Tuesday at 7, please join me for an interview with Colleen Crowninshield from the Pima Association of Governments. She's got some exciting news to share about getting electric vehicles into national parks and some other great planet-preserving news. We always learn and have fun with Colleen, so please join us. And next Saturday, Health is a Family Affair. Our guest will be Stacey Ann Tyne. She is the founder and force behind Health Barn USA. Jerome, you are one unbelievable human being. Jerome Fregenet, executive chef, thought leader, and thank you for all you're doing, and we will stay connected. Everybody, make it a great green week, and thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.